It was 1524 when William Tyndale fled out of England to Germany. He was running so that he might not be arrested as he tried to complete what he felt was God's call upon his life. His desire was to translate from the original languages of Greek and Hebrew an English Bible. A Bible that the people of England and the English-speaking world could read for themselves. But 90 years earlier, the government in England had declared that the English Bible that existed in that day, translated by Wycliffe, in fact was heretical and had to be banned, and it couldn't be printed or published or distributed in any fashion. And so Tyndale left his native land and fled so that he might work. For 11 years, he translated and hid and published and fled. And he eventually made it into Antwerp. And there, a friend betrayed him to government officials. For 18 months, he was held in prison. And then they took him, and they put a noose around his neck and branches and wood around his feet. And they hung him and burned him at the stake. He had done such great good. But the result was great suffering. Can't be right. Well, you say that was 500 years ago. And yet it doesn't take long as we begin to look around our world even today that similar acts of suffering are occurring when people commit their lives to doing good. It was just a short while ago that a woman in Nigeria heard a knock on her door, and she went to the door, and bursting into their home was a group of men who were from Boko Haram, a group of terrorists in Nigeria, and they were going through the village and cleaning out the Christians, and they grabbed her husband, who was a Christian leader, and pulled him out, and in front of her, shot him 4 times. And this woman held her husband in her arms as he bled to death. And she was alone with her 7 children. He was being a Christian, engaged in good conduct, and what he received was pain and suffering, not only for him, but for his whole family. If you're like me, you probably go, those are terrible stories, and I really feel sorry for those people, but I'm sure glad it's not me. Aren't we fortunate? We don't have that here now. But these are our people. These are our brothers and sisters. This is our family because we are the people of God. And so when they do good and suffer, we suffer with them. And in the midst of that, we feel this great tension within us. We, like them, want to do good. But at the same time, we want to minimize suffering. We want to be engaged in the kind of behavior that God desires of us, to be good as followers of Christ. But we don't want to pursue a life that would lead to pain and suffering. And the values clash for us. And make no mistake about it, that if you are going to do good in the U.S., while we may live under laws, federal and state, that protect us now, there is great pressure upon those who choose to commit themselves to Christ. Stand for life by working against abortion, and you will invite opposition and suffering. Tell the truth in a corrupt school or work environment, and you will invite opposition, suffering. Preserve yourself in moral purity for your spouse, whether future or present, and you will open the door to hostile reactions. We want to do good things, but we want to minimize the suffering that could come. So why should we do good when the result is bad? Why should we do good things when the result is going to be suffering? Difficult question. But it's the question that we want to answer this morning. And we're going to be able to find an answer in a text that was written to help us see that we have a claim, a biblical claim. And the claim is essentially that we will keep doing good even when there's suffering. And then we'll see a reason why we should live that way. And then a biblical mandate of really how to go forward. So a claim and a reason and a mandate. It's exactly what was written to people in the first century in Peter's epistle. And it was written to encourage them, to give them a sense of, okay, we can go forward. And I think that works for us as well. So if you're ready to be encouraged, we're in 1 Peter chapter 3. I invite you to turn there, and I want you to see this claim that can be kind of hard to swallow, actually, and yet it is so very true. The claim is this: it's good to do good even when suffering. It is good to do good even when we suffer for it. Doing good, having good conduct, standing up for what is right, even if it brings pain and suffering, it is always, got it? Always right. We are in 1 Peter chapter 3, and we begin with verse 17. Look at how he says it. Peter writes to his audience, who is, verse 17, for it is better, if it's God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. To unpack that just a little bit. It's better, if it's God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. What the text is saying is it's better to do good than it is to do evil. So leave the other clauses out for a minute. It's better to do good than it is to do evil. Well, we would probably say, yeah, but let's add a qualifier. It's better to do good and suffer than do evil. Well, yeah, okay. If God grants that as part of his will for you to do good and bring suffering for it, then doing good is better than doing evil. In fact, we can simply say it's good to do good even when we suffer. If you suffer for doing good, and you won't always, this is Peter's point, consider it as God's will. Did you see it there in verse 18? Or 17? If it's God's will. In other words, you can expect that if you are suffering for doing good, it's God's will. It's God didn't step out of bounds. God didn't stumble and mess up. God didn't lose sight of your situation. But this is happening because it is God's will. It's good to do good even if you're suffering. And hold it as the very will of God. Can that be right? I mean, that's quite a claim. I can imagine a first century believer saying, no, wait a minute, Peter. At some point in this process of getting suffering for doing good, at some point I probably ought to just quit. I mean, I ought to stop, right? Because certainly God wouldn't want me to suffer anymore. I mean, every time I go to the gathering of believers, I'm dragged out of the meeting place, and Roman soldiers, they come and they detain me for about 3 hours, and meanwhile my house is ransacked by soldiers looking to take my food. It is good to go to the assembly of believers, I agree, but this suffering is, it's just too much. Maybe I'll just stop going to the assembly of believers. sure, God would understand. And Peter says, no, no, my friends, it's good to do good, even if suffering. A first century reader says, wait, 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 if I refuse to go to a pagan temple, then I'm going to be beaten for it, and my clothes are going to be ripped off from me, and my children are going to be taken from me, and that's evil. How can that pain and suffering be in the will of God? Peter says, it's good to do good, even when they're suffering. I suspect that that claim from the Bible was terribly difficult for the readers of the first century to believe, to live by. This is not easy stuff, and it is still difficult today. It's hard for us to really believe it's good to do good even when we are suffering. I mean, I love being around Centerpoint because you people excel at doing good. I'm just always impressed at the amount of good behavior that happens out from this group of people. I hear story after story of care for people. We can and do endure the inconvenience of taking meals to sick members of our church. It's great. And we volunteer to help at Awana, especially since our kids are here anyway and just cost us a few hours. That's nice. And there are countless other sacrificial areas where we are people who are doing good. But what happens if the degree of suffering gets ratcheted up? And it's not just maybe inconvenient. Well, we might object, it's not so good to do good if it results in my suffering. In fact, we might call that foolishness to keep doing good in the midst of suffering, right? And you tell the truth at work, and it may cost you the promotion, or it may cost you friendships, and you're given the silent treatment, and you're left isolated from what's really happening at work. Is it still good to do good? Or should I just say what I need to prevent that kind of suffering? We need that money. Or for some of us, remaining sexually pure costs you friendships. You're left alone on a Friday night, left alone on a Saturday night, and there's a great pain of loneliness, and it can be too great. And you are tempted to conclude that, well, purity is not worth the pain. And you perhaps think, it's not so good to do good when I have to suffer like this. Or it just makes logical sense that we're going to do all we can to minimize suffering as much as possible in our lives. I mean, this is what society tells us. This is what our natural bent is. Let's be reasonable about this. At some point, we should be able to reduce suffering. God will want that for us, right? But here is the Bible's claim. It's good for us to do good, even when suffering, as God wills it. How can that be? Why would it be true that we should do good even while suffering? The Bible provides for us next a compelling reason. It's complex, it's amazing, it's wonderful, and it's what really encourages us. The Bible's reason is this, and the verses that follow, what we're going to see is that in God's economy, radical suffering ends in radical good. Radical suffering from good conduct ends ultimately in that which is radically good. Or we might say it this way, in God's value system, extreme suffering for doing good ends in extreme good. Let's see how it works. Verses 18 through 22 is where Peter makes this point. We're in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. Notice suffering followed by incredible good that happens for Christ. For Christ also suffered for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body, but made alive in the spirit. And after being made alive, he went and made proclamation to the imprisoned spirits, to those who were disobedient long ago when God waited patiently to the days of Noah while the ark was being built. In it, only a few people, eight in all, were saved through water, and this water symbolizes baptism that now saves you. Not only the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a clear conscience toward God. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into the heaven and is at God's right hand with angels and authorities and powers in submission to him. What Peter is arguing here is that in God's economy, radical suffering ends in radical good. The good is almost immeasurable. Now, this, some of you are familiar with this passage of Scripture. It has all kinds of interpretive challenges, and we could spend hours considering all of those, and we're not going to do that, because you want to go home for lunch eventually, right? What we're going to do is, where the Bible is clear, we want to be really clear, and so I'm going to start to and help us see, I hope, that the real emphasis here is that the suffering that Jesus did ended up being radical as suffering, ends up as radical good. And then we'll talk about some of these other things that help us see how true that is and how complete that is. So here we go. The end of Jesus' suffering is radical good. Look at verse 18. Here we have the statement about Jesus' suffering himself. Chapter 3, verse 18, the first part. Christ also suffered for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body. We'll just stop there. Think about this. He suffered. He suffered. Don't read that too quickly. He suffered undeservedly for us, his people. You know the story. Of course, he was arrested in Gethsemane and then held in a pit-like dungeon, dark, dank, putrid, waiting for his first trial. He stood before a Jewish council, and then the high priest accused him of blasphemy, but he did not defend himself. He went before the Roman governor, and he was accused of insurrection, being a false king. And he did not argue for his release. He was brutalized, mocked, spat upon, beaten, disrobed, humiliated, scourged. He was alone. His closest friends fled. All of them. And he staggered to Golgotha, too weak to carry his cross. And nails were driven in his hands, and he was hung on the cross to die. And his chest heaved, and lungs gasped until death came. He suffered radical, extreme suffering. And then everything changed. Because the way Peter describes this is that while Jesus was doing this good, what he experienced was radical suffering, and then it would seem at this point that there's no value to the suffering of Jesus, right? He's in the tomb. But everything changes because in the end, Jesus' radical suffering changes to radical good. Look again at some of these verses. The outcome or the product of this suffering is going to be this extreme goodness. And there are three indications here of how good it really is. It begins in the last part of verse 18 where he says, But he was made alive in the spirit realm. I take it he died in the realm of the flesh or the physical. He was made alive in the realm of the spirit. I'd probably put a small s on the spirit there. That he's talking about what happened with his new body, his resurrection. And then skipped all the way to the end of verse 22, where it becomes very clear what happened. This resurrection of Jesus, who has gone into heaven, is at God's right hand with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. What happened? He has gone from the grave to the highest place so that all powers and spiritual authorities are in submission to him. The greatest suffering became the greatest good. The exaltation of Jesus is the great reversal. And Peter says, look, this is why you would suffer even or do good even while suffering, is because when Jesus himself suffered this extreme example, the extreme way, he experienced the extreme goodness of exaltation over all. And he's placed at the right hand, right? See it? The highest place of authority. That's the end game. All that good conduct of his was not buried in the tomb. It wasn't lost forever. It was indeed to be displayed with his exaltation over all authority and power. That's the first indication that God is in this business of taking great suffering and turning it into great good. There's a second indication in this text, and it has to do with Jesus' proclamation over the evil spirits from Noah's day. We'll take a look at a couple of these clauses, but I think what Peter is saying here is he's saying that Jesus essentially began a journey. He was resurrected, and he was ascended, and on his way to his ascension, he was able to proclaim, right, to the spirits, evil spirits of Noah's day, this great victory. And here's how it works. Go back to verses 19 and 20 here, where it says, he was made alive in the realm of the spirits, in which he went and preached to the spirits in prison who disobeyed long ago during Noah's day. So there are several questions. Where did Jesus go, and how did he get there? When did he go there, and to whom did he preach, and what did he say? Here's what I think is the best answer for lots of different ways that you could look at this text. It's this. After his resurrection, and as part of his ascension to the throne, Jesus essentially went to the evil spirits. I don't think he went to a certain place, but he had a proclamation. Maybe it's even being ascended. The proclamation is he won the victory over the imprisoned spirits, over the evil spirits and demons that had been so wicked from the very earliest of time. And I think that fits the data the best. It fits best with this emphasis that Peter is making, that Jesus went from grave to exaltation. And it also fits well because of another book that was current in the first century. Some of you may have heard of it. It's called the First Book of Enoch. Probably not on your bookshelf. The First Book of Enoch was another book supposedly written by, probably not, but we don't really know who the author is, but attributed to Enoch. Now, if you're a Bible student, you know Enoch. Oh yeah, he comes up in Genesis chapter 5, right? Enoch was the one who walked with God and was not. So since he was such a righteous person in the midst of unrighteousness, he was attributed to writing this book. And in this book, it's kind of fascinating because he talks about the situation in Genesis chapter 6 where the sons of God married the daughters of men. And he speaks about the fallen angels and the demons uniting with women of the earth to create this superhuman race. And here's how he refers to them, that God has made them imprisoned spirits and will declare his victory over them. Sounds a lot like Peter. Apparently, Peter knows that the people of his day are thinking there's got to be a time when the evil spirits from all the way back in Noah's day, when God destroyed the earth, they're waiting for the final declaration of God's victory over them. And Peter says, it's happened. When Jesus ascended to the throne, this was the time when indeed the demons from Noah's day, the demons from every day, the fallen angels, the spirits, the powers, authorities, no matter where they were, they're now under the reign of Jesus. He won the victory. And all this to prove that radical suffering ends with radical good. Now there's a third indication. We've seen a couple of indications. We've got the great statement of Jesus being exalted. We've got Jesus proclaiming victory over the spirits of Noah's day. And there's this third indication here in this text that radical good is seen in how the resurrection of Jesus saves his people. The resurrection of Jesus is so powerful, it saves his people. Notice what it says here in verse 21 once again. It says, speaking about Noah and the ark, and it's like this reminds Peter of a day of water, of course, with the flood. And then he speaks about the day of baptism for God's people. Verse 21, and this water, the NIV says, symbolizes baptism that now saves you. Also, not the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a clear conscience toward God. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, if you're reading this, you kind of go, wait, baptism saves us? How does that work? It seems to be a rather confusing construction for a lot of us, right? Well, I think I can help us out. If you look in your Bible, notice how it has a little hyphen here, right? Verse 21, and this water symbolizes baptism that now saves you. Also, and then there's a M dash, it's called, a hyphen. Not by this, but by this. And then, actually, it continues. It should be another one, another M dash, asterisk of the period. This baptism saves you, how? By the resurrection of Jesus Christ. What is it that saves people? It's not baptism, per se. It is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In fact, Peter is drawing a parallel between those who are being saved by the flood and those who are being saved by the resurrection of Jesus. Peter's thought is actually quite clear. He's saying there's a parallel that baptism, or that the waters actually saved Noah as they punished the rest of the people of that day. In a similar way, through baptism, resurrection saves God's people. And is their pledge, he says, of a conscience that's committed to God. That's in the next line, where he speaks about, in that after that little M dash, he says, it saves you by not the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a clear conscience toward God. So what Peter is saying is that baptism is not going to save you. It does not. I think really he's saying removal of moral filth cannot happen through baptism. That's the real issue, right? Our moral filth. And he says it can't happen through baptism. But there is a pledge, a statement that says that you belong to the Lord. And it is in the pledge that connects us with his resurrection, not because of baptism, but because of the resurrection of Jesus, that God's people are saved. Now, you may find that all very confusing, and that's a lot in a very short time. Don't be confused. What Peter is arguing is that radical suffering for Jesus ends in radical good. How much good? It's so good that he's exalted to the highest place. And he has conquered and sits as the conquering one over all evil. Wow. Why can we be involved in doing good even when we suffer? The answer is because in God's economy, radical suffering ends with radical good. But that's hard to believe. You know, we read this text and we go, yeah, I see what it says. I think I understand what it says, but it's awfully hard to believe. We really would rather not go through pain and suffering, especially unjust suffering, right? I like having laws that are against assault because they keep me safe. And I like having seat belts because they keep us safe. And I know that if I eat right, then I'm going to prevent a painful heart attack. And so all of our lives revolves around this concept that says, I've got to be safe. I've got to be secure. I cannot suffer. Pain is always bad. And God says, no, I want you to have a different orientation. And he illustrates it with Jesus himself, whose extreme suffering results in extreme good. And that takes faith, my friends. Because if we see what we see in front of us, we will see only the horror of pain and suffering. We will see only the agony that afflicts us, our families, our friends, our world. And Peter is calling us to something much different, to lift our eyes to a greater reality. A reality that says, in God's world, extreme suffering, because of good conduct, results in extreme good. That's the reason we've heard the claim. How do we respond to that? Well, I'm going to leave most of that for Andy for next week, I think. But I'll give you a preview, because what the text essentially says is that we also then are going to engage in selfless suffering, confident in the completion of God's will. Look at the first couple of verses of chapter 4. It'll just be a little preview. Yeah, this is kind of like what they do on television. They make you come back next week. Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, I love this, arm yourselves with the same attitude. What attitude? The attitude that suffering, extreme suffering, will bring extreme goodness. Arm yourselves with that attitude, because whoever suffers in the body is done with sin. Huh? As a result, they do not live the rest of their earthly lives for human desires, but rather for the will of God. What he's saying is simply this. Those people who, like us, have said, I am going to commit myself to selfless, Christ-like suffering and doing good. They have essentially said, I'm not going to let the pull of sin and selfishness pull me away from that. I'm committed to him, and I will do where he calls me, what he calls me to do. That's the will of God, instead of the will of my own selfish pull and desires. What a privilege. What a privilege. To do good, and perhaps, if it's God's will, to even suffer for it. And then to take on this challenge that says that suffering will not pull me away from Christ, but will help me keep going. Because it's God's will. Some of you have never submitted to Christ. What a great day it would be today to make that commitment to him. Some of you have said, well, you know, I think I believe, but I've never followed the Lord in baptism. Baptism, this text holds up as a wonderful pledge in good conscience to identify with Christ, follow him, even if it brings suffering into your life. But it'll ultimately be good. For some of you, you're struggling because you're caring for someone, or you're being tempted to pull away from the truth, or tempted to give up your moral purity because you know there's suffering on the horizon when you do so. Oh, my friends, take this mandate to engage in the same attitude of Jesus. Selfless, Christ-like suffering, because ultimately there's good at the end. We may not suffer like William Tyndale and be burned at the stake, It may not be God's will for you to suffer at the hands of a terrorist group who comes and pulls people out of your house. But as long as we have breath in our lungs, life in these bodies, I hope that you will join me in saying, I want to engage in selfless suffering for Christ, confident that he's won the ultimate good. It's good to do good, even in suffering, because suffering ends in radical good.